I spent the weekend with you. Working on these. I read all that you wrote, and I'm amazed. I'm just constantly amazed when you read and put your mind on it, the clarity with which you remember these things. Now, I wouldn't clash with you, you see, on remembering it and not knowing it. I think you've got as much meaning out of it as anyone can on the first reading. And the question is, what Philip has said, not whether I can see everything is in this book, or there is any similarity to if you see Hester in the government. It's simply a question of who's batty. The children, the government, who's gone batty. That's the way it looks. Now, I don't know any remedy for that. If I were a good reader, in the balance as to whether we can see anything in the government. I've got two or three papers here. I'm just tempted to read some of them. You see, one of the two cases, I've been trying to bring in evil, and it's kind of hard to bring it in. Who's evil, and what difference does it make whether children are evil? You know they're evil, in a way. But that's really, really not the trouble. Now, I wish we had time. I've got to push just a little bit. And what I mean, I can't linger with you. I think this one circumstance you haven't considered. As to the quality of the governess's mind and her personality. She tells the story. Now, it's not just a retelling of the story, but what she does is this is an account of her looking back at this experience and accounting for it, analyzing it.
I turned it to.
This is not James. He's not in the story. It's the governess analyzing herself, and what you have there is something we have not had before.
Right.
Whitman is entirely incapable of this. Hawthorne, with all his fine penetration, simply cannot do this. You have in Hester one or two little brief glimpses where she penetrates, emancipated, freed from society. And her mind is clear, and she grapples with the age. One or two little brief sections, and in this you have a sustained account of 50 or 100 pages. And you say the governess has no mind, no personality. That it's just a question of whether she sees a ghost or not. Now, how much wrong can a man be? Misjudging, you see? Absolute, fundamental misreading. But everybody misreads it. You'd have to read it a week or two. And if you read a little while and came back to it, you'd see more in it. So it's not as bad as I represent it at this moment. let me tell you how, where I got my most light on this. Ever since I first knew this, I have found it one of the most charming, ingratiating stories. Great kindness, great penetration in it. Well, I remember my family came down here, a little girl, when she finished high school. And her parents wanted her to go to one of the schools back up the country, up east. And she felt like she had just dawdled in high school. And she knew she just couldn't make it up there. And she came down here, and one summer, it was a course something like this that they had in the curriculum then. And she came down here to read that with me. You know, members of a family best seldom read with you. She went by the beach and spent a week just out of high school, you see. And she sat in the stray over there and read Moby Dick. And she read the first 100 pages beautifully. And she couldn't get past that. She got past it, but she really didn't. You know, she was harassed all summer. I thought she was just going to break down and have to go home. And when she got to the governess, it was love at first sight. It wasn't that. But there was a fascination for the governess had for her, which I had never encountered before. I knew the governess was interesting, and I liked the governess, but I didn't realize she was just a full-bodied character.
That she would speak to anybody.
Now, you see, I've lived with this a good while. Now, let's see what happens. At the very beginning, this first narrator warns you that she is young, experienced, deprived, and infatuated. Everything is against her. And at the same time, he says that she was one of the most charming persons he had ever known. Now, that was later, you see, that he knew her. Well, now, that gives you a little lead. Now, let me show you. Now, let's look at her own accounting for what happened in this experience. I don't know how in the world anyone can miss it. The very first word she says opens up the whole thing. Her very first words. Look at chapter 1 and read the first sentence. Now, where her narrative starts. I remember the whole beginning. Now, watch this. As a succession of flights and drops. A little seesaw of the right throbs and the wrong. Of depressions and elevations, after being discouraged and encouraged. A succession of flights and drops. Now look at that very beginning. You see her state of mind. I had at all events, after arriving in town, I had at all events a couple of very bad days. I found myself doubtful again. And felt sure I had made a mistake. And then as she drives through the country at that hour on a lovely day, through the country to which the summer sweetness seemed to offer me a friendly welcome. Now there's the drop and the flight, where she's torn between assurance and uncertainty. What the ghosts do, or the apparitions, or what she calls her dreadful disability. I look at the next paragraph. I had no drop again till the next day. And then the little girl who accompanied this ghost was so charming. And I was too much excited. You see? And the only thing, indeed, that in this early outlook might have made me shrink again was a clear circumstance of her being so glad to see me. And she's suspicious. that raises a doubt where the charm of the little girl assures her. Now you see her state of mind from the very beginning. Great uncertainty. And look at what she says on the next page. One should flatter a child, oh miss, most remarkable she is, if you think well of this one. And she stood there with a plate in her hand, beaming at our companion, who looked with, from one of us to the other with placid heavenly eyes that contained nothing to check us. Yes, if I do, you will be carried away by the little gentleman. If you think highly of this one, you'll simply be carried away by the little gentleman. Well, that, I think, is what I came for, to be carried away. Now, look at what the state that she is on, that she's getting into. Let's examine it just a little bit. Now, look. The letter precedes the boy. The letter brings a, she says in chapter 2, the letter brings a second sleepless night. And in the letter it said that this charming boy was an injury to the others. Now, you see, something else is in it to hang over her. See, she has just a job, and she has to make a go of it. Now, this evil that's unspecified hangs over her. Now, look at Quint, the first appearance of Quint. Now, look. Now, you see, that's a beautiful scene. But what she's out there for is... Yes, she is. This is in that's one of those marvelous little passages where she talks about my own hour, and she's out on the ground, and she is expecting to meet someone. The master, of course. And what does she see? She sees this picture of Quint. You see, appearance of Quint. Just up there where she had been with the children the day before, when Flora was showing around. Now look, what she does is look back and try to understand her experience. Now here, you might say, is the first analysis. It produced in me, this figure in the clear twilight I remember, two distinct gasps of emotion, which were sharply the shock of my first and that of my second surprise. My second was a violent perception of the mistake of my first. The man who met my eyes was not the person I had precipitately supposed. And then a little lower, she says, I have made it the whole feeling of the moment returned. Now look at that great capacity she has of calling up the scene in such detail as to analyze it. It was as if, while I took it in, what I did take in, all the rest of the scene had been stricken with death. I can hear again, as I write, the intense hush in which the sounds of evening drop. The rooks stop coy in the summer sky, and the friendly hour lost for the moment all its voices. Then this is a sustained analysis. The great question that people ask about these is, how long do they last? And from her own experience, she goes into it. Well, this experience of mine, think what you will of it, lasted while I caught a dozen possibilities, none of which made a difference for the better that I could see in their having been in the house and for a person whom I was in ignorance of. And then... it lasted while this visitant, at all events, seemed to fix me from his position with just the question, just the scrutiny through the fading light that his own presence provoked. We were too far apart to catch each other, But there was a moment at which, at shorter range, some challenge between us broke out. So it's the governess's mind through which you see this. Oh, now I'm tired talking. You talk a little bit. You know what that is? You picked out the critical passage of the whole book, on which it's the foundation, it's the key to the whole story. The whole structure of the apparitions is based on that one scene. Now, what you have to do is start that from James' point of view. That he uses all that uncanny artistry of his to make that convincing. I think in this one case, you have to sort of take the point of view of the writer.
That's the scene in which the governess identifies Quint.
Of course, it works out. You never know what Miles did at school, but you see a great deal of evil in this story. I'd approach that just a little bit differently. Let me see how I would go about that. You see, after Quint's second appearance, did you notice that? That's number six. That's the first time she breaks the news to the governor. I mean, to the Miss Groves. They shut themselves up all night. This is a crisis, an emergency. And this can just send her home, you see, as an utter failure. She loses her job. She got no more prospects with the master. And you see, she's playing pretty risky game. So they shut themselves up and talk about it, thrash it out. You see that? It took, of course, more than a particular passage together in the presence of what we had now to live with as we could. My dreadful liability to impressions of the order so vividly exemplified, and my companion's knowledge that here henceforth. And all is half consternation and half compassion. Now that's Mrs. Gross's attitude. Miss Gross seated, half consternation and half compassion. There had been this evening, after the revelation that left me for an hour so prostrate, there had been for either of us no attendance on any service but a little service of tears and vows, of prayers and promises. I see that. You see, you're looking at the wrong thing when you read this. What you look at, you see, is that disturbance that they feel. You see, it's real. Now, it doesn't matter whether it's a ghost or something else as far as that goes. Now, look, in that same passage, and she comes to one of the first of those brilliant perceptions of hers, and you have to say it is, that's the same thing that Hester saw and experienced. I know, and my exaltation grew. You see that line? That's in chapter 6. And you know, my dear, she didn't deny this, but I felt, not even so much telling as that. She resumed in a moment at any rate. Now, what if he should see him? Little Miles, she says. That's what he wants. That's what Peter Quint is after. Now look what that does. Look at what that does in that same section. I scarce know how to put my story into words that shall be a credible picture of my state of mind. But I was, in these days, literally able to find a joy in the extraordinary flight of heroism that the occasion demanded of me. Now you see the flight and the drop. They are in despair while they think that over that night. And now she's got it. She sees her first. She has her first thought. It passed. her mind. Now what happens, you see, out there, the first time, the governess, for the first time, introduces evil, where this beautiful child, she's watching her for signs of duplicity. Now, if you can think of anything more disastrous, on the positive identity of the apparition, I would assure myself as soon as the small clock of my courage, she doesn't look up. She won't even look at the apparition to see that it's there. She just feels it's there. Now watch what happens. My courage has ticked out this right second. Meanwhile, with an effort that was already sharp enough, I transferred my eyes straight to little Flora. Not at the apparition that she feels is there, but at little Flora, who at the moment was about 10 yards away. My heart had stood still for an instant with the wonder and terror of the question whether she would see. And I held my breath while I waited for what a cry from her, what some sudden innocent sign, either of interest or alarm, would tell me. Now look, that comes to the head. Show me now where that other one is, the one I asked you about yesterday. I can't find things like you can. See, she's watching the little girl again. Our companion on this. You look at the paragraph. I want you to see this. This is about 2 or 3 pages over in chapter 20. Our companion on this had responded with a strange, quick primness of propriety. And they were again, with Mrs. Gross on her feet, united, as it were, in painful opposition to me. Flora continued to fix me with her small mask of reprobation. And even at that minute, I prayed God to forgive me for seeming to see that as she stood there holding tight to our friend's dress, now you watch, her incomparable childish beauty had suddenly failed. Had quite vanished. I've said it already. She was literally, she was hideously hard. She had turned common and almost ugly. Now you say that's an apparition. That's a normal human experience. Where a person with whom you have had pleasant dealings, after some such complicating factors can enter, and it doesn't take long, can turn into perfect ugliness right before you. Central. Now this is so much stronger than Whitman, but it is Whitman. And you look back at that passage in Emerson, that what I call the Joanna Bach passage, but he says right glibly, this Reverend Divine had said to him one time, what are you going to do with these impulses of yours that you value so highly? What are you going to do if they are from below and not from above? And remember what he said. He's glib about it. Hester. Hester, we say, never faced this dilemma. She suffered. But in a way, Hawthorne never raises the question whether those impulses of hers were from below. And what James here does, at the same time that Freud is doing the same thing, he's saying that this spirit of inquiry, this feeling of pursuit, you see, of one's own intuition can most certainly be disastrous. Now you've seen it. We don't live in a world of innocence any longer. We live in the world of the governess. Now we have a common name for it. The name is so common that we hardly pay much attention to it any longer. What the governess feels and what we continually feel is just sheer anxiety. I come in here to meet with you. I'm always uncertain, unstable. I don't know whether we'll make it or not, you see. You take your test and do all your reading, see all your friends, and you'll continually, you see, have that feeling. You see, this is the end of the Emersonian world. You see it take that violent end as that beautiful child is transformed into something ghastly and ugly. You see, in a way, Hester can no longer be victorious. The governor seems to set the pattern. We can do is just look back at that little paradise that they almost created. Mark Twain going across the country, and that old stagecoach sitting on a dictionary, his feet dangling, and thinking of all those stories about the jackrabbit moth, and his hair blowing in the breeze. It lasted just a while. In order to say that to you, I have to confront you a whole time. What I'm expected to do is come in here and talk about literary history and lecture you about the lives and works of these writers. There has to be this distinction. Do you want to study the writer? Or you want to hear what he said? I meet up with any number of people who are authorities as students, as young people, on Emerson. I never have the feeling that they know Mr. Emerson. Hear beautiful analyses of the Scarlet Letter. Just brilliant theoretical discussion. Somehow I just never feel that Hester is present in them. I lived in a world of the spoken word, and I wish you could hear the Dimmesdale. I wish you could read that again and hear Dimmesdale's word as Hawthorne represents it. It's just a marvelous world that they have created for themselves.
Well,
I'm you know, I feel I'm well read when it comes to anthologies, especially freshman anthologies. Read much else, but I'm well read in freshman anthologies. Now, one of the articles that has meant so much to me is Margaret Mead's article in one of the old C3 anthologies. Now, let me show you what this is. Listen a minute, and I'll tell you what she's talking about. Margaret Mead, each family in a home of its own. that every family should have a home of its own seems like a truism to which every American would assent without second thought. Most Americans who accept the fact that we have a housing shortage as a consequence of a failure to build in the 30s and during World War II, and of discrepancies between housing cost and wages that should somehow be reconciled. But it is important to realize that the word family has come to mean fewer and fewer people. The number of families has steadily increased, and so the need for housing units as distinguished from living space has increased by leaps and bounds. Now, marriage is a state towards which young Americans are propelled, and within which American women, educated to be energetic and active, try to live out the desires that have both been encouraged and muffled in them as children. When immigrants, the woman rules the home. When immigrants came to this country, the husband set to work to make a living, the wife to find out how to live. And this division between making a living and a way of life, one is man's field, the other is woman's, has been intensified. As more schools are consolidated and as the distance from home is increased and as school lunches develop, the home with the school-aged children is deserted all day long while mother is free to study the magazines and rearrange the living room or her knowledge of world peace or the community school system in between answering the telephone, waiting for the laundryman, and doing the next errand. Now, you wait just a minute. Now, let me just paraphrase it, or restate it. At one point, it looked like the well-equipped home would have all the labor-saving devices, and the woman's place, you see, would be just sitting back in the parlor. A vacuum cleaner was a great addition to a home that kept the standards of a carpet sweeper and a broom. Laundries were a godsend to a household whose routine of sheet-changing was geared to the old-fashioned wash tub. But just as our new medical palliatives are creating new vulnerabilities, so the new equipment has led not to more leisure, more time to play with the baby, more time to curl up and read by an open fire or to help with the PTA, but is merely combined with other trends in making the life of the American homemaker not easier, but more exacting. Now, home the here is the father and the mother and the children and nobody else. Now, if we have narrowed the home, excluded from it the grandmother, the unmarried sister, the unmarried daughter, and as part of the same process of repudiating any sharing of a home with another adult, the domestic servant has been vanished. We have multiplied the number of homes in which the whole life of the family has to be integrated each day. Meals cooked, lunches packed, children bathed, doors locked, dog walked, cats put out, food ordered, washing machine set in motion, flowers sent out. And the man comes home and thinks, had a bad long day at the office, and thinks his wife, you see, had nothing to do all day. You know, as I think about this, and it just came to me one time, not long ago, just what was in there. Leaving school and your own family and becoming established in the world, settling down, is a greater act of faith. And the act is taken against greater odds than anything I think that ever happened in the Middle Ages, the age of faith. You know, members of the college community think once they settle down, they'll get to read, and they'll get to visit with their friends. When I see my old students, I want to say, well, what do you think of Emerson now? And then I know better. They don't have an open copy of Emerson. They've They have thrown it away, and some cleaning the house. Sold it, you know, at the end of the course. And the boy had a job. You say he doesn't work much, just 8 hours. But then he comes home at night, and he has to see some of his business friends. Because in our time, it's impossible to keep a job without getting a promotion. And then you think of the pressure that's on the governess. We just enter a world in which we invite that pressure from every direction. Here you see the transfer, the world of Emerson, in which people at least read Thoreau. So this world we live in, we just don't have the heart to read. Not anymore. Now, I don't want to be this one about this. I want to say this to you. I think this offers more insight into our time and into our own individual prospects than anything I know. You can see it in the governess. You see, she lives in this world of anxiety. She's pushing. She wants to succeed. She wants to lose herself, what did she say? If any one person can do that, and just extend this as far as he can, up to a point, and before the crash comes, withdraw, and let the Constitution mend, you see. Don't go all the way like the governor did. But go just as far as you can. And then come back. And after I see this and have somebody like you to talk to about it, what I want to do is just go around and talk to all the marvelous people that I have met, the young people. And say, read the governess, and get a little insight into this great calamity you're facing, you see, by your whole personality and be just disrupted. You kind of dip back into that Emersonian world. I think we can recover it just a little bit.
I didn't bring in the institutions from society that Emerson's talking about, all of which scotch the pursuit of the individual's intuitions. But I'll try to remember to do that next time.
See, to start with, you say, why bring in Emerson? Why don't you just read Hawthorne? That's the world they lived in. That's the marvelous, beautiful world. World of Whitman. I can also show you Whitman's world crashed around him almost overnight, and I can show you that. I can read your articles that show it. It gave way. I'm going to tell you tomorrow. You know, I just love keeping my mind talk about it for a day or two. Things will come to you. See, this will stay in your mind. You'll think about it when you ought to be thinking about something else. And you go back and read a few of these little packages of government and you a governess, and you'll see how charming she is. And how much like Hester Thoreau she is. You see that, and you'll feel it. Bad news for you on that other little test. That's right, Miss. I ask you plain statements of fact, and hardly anybody in here passed the test. I won't scold you. But I'm going to give it back to you tomorrow. As sort of a warning to get hold of some of this matter before you finally change it. So I can ask you some of these solid questions. But you see what I'm interested in, largely. But you see, in the world as it is now, I can't let solid matter go. When you get home, sit down on a piece of paper and your notes. Restate the things that I have talked with you about this morning. That's a definite step in the discussion. Now, I would let Paul go, but I think you hold against me. Yes, he's now. So I want to read it before I gave you the assignment. Now, you want to. You're going to look for ghosts again. Yes. You see, I've worked with you all the time. I don't think you've ever had anyone who worked as closely with you and has had as much regard for your thinking as I have done this time. And I don't think it's quite cricket for you to get mad at me and talk about me when you go out. You talk about Hester.
That's the end of Monday, March the 4th, 68. That's the end of Monday, March the 4th. Now, this is the start of Wednesday, March the 6th. This is the start of Wednesday, March the 6th. This is a continuation of the discussion of turning the screw, and it lasted longer than I meant for it to.
I wish you could get together and sort of speak to each other when you meet. I asked one of my students one time, the girl she's sitting right next to, or some little business they need to get together on. I said, "Do you ever see her?" She says, "No, I hope I never do." They just sat there the whole time, and they just despised each other. He has that Shakespearean gift, you know. Shakespeare doesn't know how many plots he carries on in his plays. You see, if I were doing it, I'd get it all confused. I'd have to outline it, you see, and be able to get it straight. And as you read these things, you're pretty well flooded with the details, aren't you? Governess is putting on them. I don't know the whole story, you see, but she has so much pressure herself. She's right on the point of busting out the courts, you see, all along. And then she has this gifted nature, and she responds so much, you see, she's excitable. And she has what she calls this, what does she call it in that passage last time? It's her ability to see the apparitions. What does she call that? My dreadful liability. You see, she knows at the time, not only 20 years afterwards or whenever it was she wrote this analysis, but she knows at the time now, you see, that's in question. And that's the turn of the screw. And that's that same idea of, that's actually the Freudian part of it, of anxiety. Now, you think of Freudian as something else. Huh? Now, I'm taking you in a direction you didn't want to go. You go ahead and talk a little bit more, and I'll stay out of it. That was a 17th century idea, not 19th century. But he couldn't write about the 17th century without sticking a little of it in. I see, we ought to have plenty of time to air these things. That's the shameful part of it, isn't it? What is it? What is it? What sort of machine is it where you can just clear it all and just, press the button? And all the buttons go in the safe. Isn't there something like that? A computer or something or other. Isn't there some sort of machine where you can do that? Well, you can't do that in this, you see. It just takes a while to get your thoughts in place. Now, you know how I do that, Ken? You know, I'm not a believer in the mind. I never had much of one. So I have to rely on other faculties. And I just sort of get full of it and let it come to me. Just to approach something and think it out, you see, would be just a formidable thing for me. I envy people who can do that. I don't envy them. I don't think it can be done. But you see, that. Children all along just want to be children. And little boy has got to the point where he doesn't want to be a child anymore. He's sort of grown up. Also that, wouldn't you say? And it's the governess, you see, who puts that pressure on him. But then you come back, as far as the story comes, to that Peter Quint, both the Peter Quint episodes. I mean, the apparitions. And that scotches you. Well, now, I told you about that last time. Yes, I did. I told you exactly about that. Now, anybody remember that? Now, you understand, I didn't mean that I got the last word on that, you understand? I think you have to allow the writer some artistic leeway. When he tells a story, he's got to frame it up against you at some point. Now, what he does through
that
Peter Quint, he shows two or three things. One, the governess's great power to examine and pursue and have these first thoughts. And the other thing, he stacks the cards against you and lets her tell you things about Peter Quint that she doesn't know. So artistically, you see, just for the mere sheer point of writing a book, you got to allow him that Peter Quint episode. don't know quite how you do that. It could be, you see, this is, James is such a sophisticated artist that, that's a tour de force of James's. I mean, that's the only way I can look at it. Let's pass on to something else. Karen, start us back where you were. What do you think about the turn of the screw now? Well, it doesn't have to be mentioned. It's a title, and you carry it through. I mean, this ought to be on your mind all the time. And the governess is always turning the screw. From almost the very first. From almost the very first, she's turning the screw. And also, it's being turned on her. And it's not a weird story. It's an exciting thing. It's just an exciting and fascinating and charming, charming. Don't you feel the charm in the story? Governess, what she sees in the children, you know, that's charming. What she sees in the old manor house, that's charming. And then the governess herself, it just has great charm, great charm. Now, I forget where we are, I get off on some tack like that. Oh, yes, turn the screw. Well, you see, she turned the screw on little Flora until little Flora just fell apart. You remember that? And that's the end of the story for the governess. She's lost out. All she's got to do now is turn in the keys. But you've got this element, you've got this second part in a way. You see now, you see there's so much, I don't know, I'll call on you in a minute. There's so much of this in a way that I don't have the faintest idea of what's happening, you see. It looks like two stories to me. But in a way, what you do, she finishes off Flora, and that's not quite enough. James wants you to see it go further, and lets her finish off the boy with this pressure. She won't let him be children. And why won't she? You see, she's under such pressure. He's under such pressure. Oh, it works so many ways. You know the concept of anxiety. But it really doesn't mean much to you. You've never come face to face with it, have you? Have you ever felt it? I don't believe unless you felt it, you can get in the governess's position. Unless you've been up to the point where you're just about to break, not know it from reading about it, but from living it, you've been sheltered by too many things. You've got somebody to lean on. You see, she doesn't have anybody there. A family? No family. And James has rigged it. James, you see, has rigged it so she has nothing to lean on. Miss Gross, who can't read. Well, you see, you have hardly got into the story, and there's not a thing I can say to you. You're not into it. You're just playing with it. Yes. I do think though. The farther along, you see, you get in your reading, the more you can take suggestions and go ahead with them. You'll never find anybody to work out things with you much. Now, you won't find articles or books. You see, they'll go very far. You almost ought to take one or two little ideas and then work it out yourself. Actually. Sure. No, that's a disease on her part. That's a symptom of her anxiety. Now that's Freud. Now you talk about Freud. Can't you apply him a little bit? You see, in the first place, what she does is this high regard she has for the master. She transfers those to the place and to the children. And then that is intensified by that ups and downs, you see, that great anxiety she feels. It's intensified. So you see, it's a symptom. So the children are too Tommy. She looks back at it later and diagnoses her own experience and shows it to you in that light. And that, in a way, you see, is the thing that should absolve most of your questions, is that this is in her, after she's recovered from this, this is her diagnosis of what happened. She tells you that. Now, you haven't said a thing, Dan. Shows you precisely what he did in school to get kicked out. He acts it out, and he does it early in the story. Now, I'm going to tell you, I think you are suspicious. I think the whole trouble in here, with all of you gifted people, and all of you in here are, is that you are suspicious. Now look, I've been working with people like you all my life, in one way or another, and I'm not going to come in here and tell you something I don't know. I'm not going to mislead you, and unless I'm certain of it, I won't even bring it up. And in the whole course, not only this one, but in any course I work in, my whole point is to work along and give as much rope as I can to the individuals in the class and let them get involved in their own subject. And it looks at times, you see, as if I'm letting them go, but I'm not. I keep it under control all the time. I won't work with material that I don't have some mastery of. Now, you see, you're suspicious of me. You think I want to flunk you or trick you. You see, you... You won't go along with me. I told you, I've been telling you this same thing from the very beginning. Now we got to this point. Now look at the evil that he does. Now you see, you look at me as if I'm going to cross you up or that I'm going to hold it against you. I've got this bad set of papers that I've got to give back to you. But I'm not mad at you. You get so put out with me. Now, you haven't seen the evil that he did, but you don't want to know. you brother can take her home, the picture of yourselves is very perceptive. But you see, I'm not telling you anything to show you that I'm perceptive. It's something I picked up talking with other people about this story. And I read this thing no telling how many times before it came to me, or somebody told me, I've forgotten now, that the evil was acted out in here. And you haven't seen it yet. Well, I don't have to. We don't have to go into it. He is so, James.
I knew I was off on a wrong limb right at all the time I was talking and lecturing him like that. Now, this will carry over a little bit on pole on the other side. That would be channel one over. That would be channel one over, continuing this the 6th of March, Wednesday. It'll be continued now on channel one over of the 6th of March.